spread in prisons or allow it to get worse. The Federal Bureau of Prisons lowered the rate of compassionate releases, and the agency used only a fraction of the COVID drugs that it was allotted to help treat people in prison, compounding upon already inadequate health care for imprisoned people. Meanwhile, many prisons doubled down on the cruelest form of punishment, increasing the number of people in solitary confinement, choosing to abuse, neglect, and torture people rather than releasing them in compliance with social distancing measures to avoid infection. The UCLA data is the first comprehensive report of pandemic-era prison deaths. The UCLA law researchers said the data is meant to provide the public with knowledge about prison mortality rates, as federal and state governments have failed to keep proper records. Aaron Littman, acting director of UCLA Law COVID Behind Bars Data Project, told New York Times that the public should know what happens to people in the U.S. when they are thrown into prison. Data on deaths in prisons has been suppressed for decades. Congress passed a bill to increase transparency of deaths of imprisoned people in 2000, known as the Death in Custody Reporting Act. But the U.S. Government Accountability Office found the vast majority of states were submitting incomplete reports under the law. Further, in 2021, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, a branch of the Department of Justice, announced that it was going to stop collecting such data entirely. Combined with the fact that many U.S. states have stopped reporting COVID cases in prisons, data around death of imprisoned people is woefully lacking. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to take a look at the lessons we can learn from the life of one of the most prominent and impactful Muslims to have ever lived in the West, Malcolm X. Malcolm was brutally gunned down in February 1965, but his journey from non-Muslim criminal to one of the loudest and most eloquent Muslim voices in the face of US racism and oppression still inspires millions of Muslims worldwide today.
On February 21, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down whilst preparing to give a speech in New York City's Audubon Ballroom. The killing brought to a premature end one of the most inspirational revolutionary careers the world had ever known. Malcolm X is mostly renowned as a political figure of huge significance across the black and Muslim world for his tireless efforts to confront and combat racism, imperialism, and global injustice.
The history of unpunished violence against our people clearly indicates that we must be prepared to defend ourselves, or we will continue to be a defenseless people at the mercy of a ruthless and violent racist mob.
Born Malcolm Little in the U.S. state of Nebraska in 1925, his early childhood was marred by the murder of his father by white racists. In his teens, he eventually ended up in New York City. There, he spiraled into a life of crime, which ended in his arrest for burglary in 1946. Whilst in jail, Malcolm studied a variety of ideologies, eventually adopting the black nationalism of the Nation of Islam. a group he joined upon his release in 1952, rising through the ranks to minister and spokesperson. His fiery, passionate speeches against American racism garnered him popularity. He also urged the black community to become educated, strong, and self-sustainable. Eventually, Malcolm outgrew the Nation of Islam, and after performing the Hajj pilgrimage in 1964, embraced traditional Islam. Malcolm X was amongst the early voices to criticize the U.S. war on Vietnam. During the same period, he became a significant figure in advancing civil rights with his rhetorical power proving his greatest assets. Three black men were arrested for Malcolm X's assassination, two of them not at the shooting scene that day. Decades on, the legacy of Malcolm X remains strong. His family and millions of followers still doubt the police investigation, wondering whether his real killers were let go by bigger powers.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about the life of Malcolm X is Ahmed Hussein from Muslim advocacy group Impact UK, which has held up Malcolm X as a role model for Muslims in the West, and Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who joins us on Skype. He's a Muslim scholar and lecturer based here in the UK. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Ahmed, I'm going to come straight to you on this and just ask, obviously you guys have pushed the legacy of Malcolm X in a lot of the work that you do. Just tell me, why is Malcolm X such an important role model for Muslims in the West?
Sure. It's because he was so able to articulately explain how a community of people, he was first talking about the black people in America, but his thoughts on how people can free themselves of oppression is still a blueprint for ourselves in the Muslim world today. Basically, he understood that freedom comes from resilience in a community. It's not a case of people saying, oh, if we can get rid of such and such a political leader, such and such political party coming in, that isn't enough. To reach that strength, to reach that resilience, it has to come from oneself and from one's community. And so when you listen in on his speeches, when you read his letters, and you read his autobiography, you realise that what he's telling people to do is to have a sense of pride in who they are. And obviously, as Muslims, and in his later time as a Orthodox Muslim himself, that means in ourselves as Muslims, in our identity, and in Islam as a religion. Particularly when he was saying that America needs to understand Islam, we could actually flip that over in the modern context. Muslims need to understand Islam better, whereas Malcolm X saw in Islam and the Muslim community of his time a force for overcoming racism and division, and the answers to the social ills of the Americas at the time. We as Muslims, we need to understand that Islam is inherently a force for good and a force for change. And until we understand that, like Malcolm X did, we will remain in this state of oppression that we are in today.
For sure. Now, Sheikh, let me come to you and bring you in on this discussion. Now, tell me, how did Malcolm X inspire you personally?
How Malcolm X has influenced me to even become a Muslim is because of the fact that Malcolm X saw Islam not only as the final truth, but also, when I say the final truth, I mean the final revelation of the truth that has been occurring throughout the ages. But also he saw Islam as a liberation theology. If we are aware of the struggle for justice of African Americans and Africans in the diaspora, we know that their oppression is a totalistic one. It is not just merely an economic or a social or a cultural type of revolution, but it is also a revolution in terms of our image of the divine, or our understanding, I would rather say, of the divine.
Well, that is indeed fascinating. And Ahmed, I'm going to come back to you because you mentioned some interesting points earlier about the fact that the Muslim community is in a state of oppression right now. Tell me, how can we compare Malcolm X to the type of community leadership that we have in the Muslim community today. It seems as if perhaps we're lacking some of that fiery, hard-hitting passion that Malcolm X was so famous for.
And I think passion is the word for it. He really understood that racism, that divisiveness, was destroying not just American society, but the very lives of the people around him that he saw. And that is what really drove him. That is what drove him in terms of his drive for unity. And that is something that our Muslim leaders need to realize. Islam in itself is intrinsically about unity and justice. And, you know, unfortunately, we see too many imams, you know, in the UK context, I can speak very candidly about. Unfortunately, in the UK context, we have too many mosque leaders who see their mosques as an opportunity to run some kind of social club on ethnic lines. And it's not just about unity. Our mosque leaders, our Muslim leaders are just so small-minded. We shouldn't forget that the last few years of Malcolm X's life was spent in doing a tour of Africa and other black nations. Why? Because he wants to internationalize the cause that was so important to him. Mm. Racism in the US, he realized, needed to become internationalized because he wanted to push it as a priority, as something that needs to be resolved through the UN. So our Muslim leaders today, not only are they divisive, they're just too small-minded. And that's why, as a community, we are so riddled with issues.
For sure. Now, before we carry on this discussion, gentlemen, Malcolm X, of course, was very renowned for his fiery oratory, and some of his speeches have gone down among the most memorable and quotable of all time. Let's play out some of Malcolm X at his best.
Because nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal.
The police, the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this, and it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves.
Well, known as a black nationalist for most of his career, towards the end of his short life, Malcolm embraced Orthodox Islam, influenced by the Hajj pilgrimage he took in 1964. Whilst in the holy city of Mecca, he wrote a powerful letter to colleagues back in New York. Here are some of the extracts.
America needs to understand Islam, because this is the one religion that erases from its society the race problem. Throughout my travels in the Muslim world, I have met, talked to, and even eaten with people who in America would have been considered white. But the white attitude was removed from their minds by the religion of Islam. I have never before seen sincere and true brotherhood practiced by all colours together, irrespective of their colour. During the past 11 days here in the Muslim world, I have eaten from the same plate, drunk from the same glass, and slept on the same rug while praying to the same God with fellow Muslims whose eyes were the bluest of the blue. whose hair was the blondest of the blonde, and whose skin was the whitest of white. And in the words and in the deeds of the white Muslims, I felt the same sincerity that I felt amongst the black African Muslims of Nigeria, Sudan, and Ghana. We were all truly the same brothers, because their belief in one God had removed the white from their minds, the white from their behaviour, and the white from their attitude.
I'm going to go straight to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif once again and bring you in on this discussion. Now, Sheikh, tell me about this part of Malcolm X's great life. Obviously, we know about the days mostly when he was identified as a black nationalist, when he served with the Nation. But what about the fact that he became an Orthodox Muslim later in life? What about Malcolm the Muslim?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to separate the issue of black nationalism. We have to know what he meant by that. And we have to separate that from a black counter-racism, you see. I think in terms of the black counter-racism, which goes back to the ideology of the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, you know, despite what the error of this, it was quite a liberating thing for the African American. And the reason why is because the white supremacist establishment painted the world in a kind of an evolutionist type of a way, where it saw the darker races of mankind as inferior and the white races of mankind as, you know, superior. And what Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam did was they flipped that around. And they basically said, you know, who is the person who was guilty of the most oppression and the most killing and the most genocide and so forth? And if there's anybody who was supposed to be a devil, it wasn't a black man, but it was a white man. Of course, you can see how liberating that was. You know, it's like, for example, you know, many of the, let's say, third world or what's so-called third world countries, how they look at America, for example, and in Europe. You know, they all emulate Europe, they all emulate America because they believe that, quote unquote, they are the most advanced nations in the world. And by virtue of that fact, or that illusion, they find themselves under the foot of these organizations, of these countries. And so therefore, when one flips the switch on them and say, no, these are the most, let's say, for example, in an extreme sense, the most depraved countries in the world, it kind of changes that psychological orientation. What he meant by black nationalism is that, look, black people should not be expecting their oppressor to give them rights. Black people should take their rights. And one of the ways that you can take your right is to be self-sufficient, is to not spend your money trying to whiten your skin and straighten your hair and color your hair and putting on colored contact lenses and dancing the night away. You know, that what black people should do is pool the economic resources to be economically independent in the United States of America or in the world as possible with justice. And so they will be able to stand up on their own two feet and fight international oppression, you know, on their own. And so by the time he ended up going to Hajj, what he realized is that Muslims or Islam was not a racist religion. In fact, that he saw Muslims, as he describes it in his autobiography, whose skin was the whitest of white, whose eyes were the bluest of blue. And when you ask them about their race, they would say, well, yeah, I'm white, but it's white as a kind of, you know, one of those phenomena, you know, that describes them. That's all, you see. He said, it's different when a white man calls himself white in America. You know, it means that I'm superior. I'm the boss. And with this experience among the Muslims, he realized that, you know, this ideology of the Nation of Islam was wrong. And he came back to America with a message that was now also potent for white people to get involved.
Ahmed, I'm going to bring you in again on this. Now, obviously, Malcolm X, outspoken, he wasn't afraid of anyone. I mean, what a man he truly was. We certainly miss him now. But do you think that there is just a real problem here of Muslims just being too scared to speak out? Perhaps they're too worried about their job security, their financial stability. Malcolm X prioritized his community, first and foremost, and his beliefs.
Yeah, he prioritized justice. And he's described racism as the most explosive and pernicious evil. And so when you've got a view of an injustice like that, the passion for justice is inevitable, and that is what drove him. And so we have to question ourselves, what is our driving force in life? Is it justice? Is it even Islam? Or is it, as you said, is it our job security? Is it our comfort in our life? Because the thing is, and yet again, you know, why is Malcolm X still relevant to our lives, you know, so many decades on? Just a few weeks ago, in the UK context, just a few weeks ago, there was a report going into the counter-extremism strategy called Prevent. And what it basically detailed, you know, there's loads of interesting quotes in there. One of them is that, you know, quote-unquote Islamists use Islam as a way to define their political and moral judgments. Well, yeah, that's what every Muslim does. And yet, so what we're seeing here in the UK modern context and across the West as well, we're seeing a criminalization of Islam. And just like in Malcolm X's time, we saw the black man, the black woman, the black community being vilified, being denigrated, being satirized. And then that hatred became internalized. Likewise, we're seeing that happen with the Muslim community today as well. We are getting so used to seeing ourselves through the lens of those who want to control us that we see ourselves as suspicious. We see our behaviors as suspicious. Mm. We see, we got to be more careful than the non-Muslim next door. Well, the words that we say, the tone with which we say, with which we speak.
One of the things Malcolm X spoke about, one of his most famous speeches, was the house. I guess we would say house Muslim in our case.
Field Muslim,
yeah. Yeah, field Muslim, that type of thing. What do you make of that? It still rings true today, surely.
That speaks to the effectiveness of propaganda. We've internalized something other than Islam. If we looked at ourselves through the lens of taqwa, through the lens of what does Allah want us to do, would we be seeing ourselves with such self-hatred? We need to revive our understanding of Islam. Malcolm X, you could say that, look, he was an Orthodox Muslim for not even a year. What does that say of us? So those of us who are born into the religion, those of us who revert and, you know, spend years or decades in the religion. If we are internalizing self-hatred, we need to revive our connection with Islam. That is something that is, if we take nothing else from Malcolm X's life, we should take that one thing, that a desire for justice, a desire for closeness to Allah, a desire for the truth, that is the one thing that is worth being driven by. Otherwise, we're going to live sad, pathetic lives achieving nothing.
Yes, stand by your people, I think, is a strong message. Sheikh Hanif, let me bring you in on this again. Of course, some of the views which Malcolm had in his early career, he began to distance himself from or reject even towards the end of his life. Things like the white devil terminology. Do you think that it's fair to say that some of Malcolm X's opinions and views could be classed as racist towards the beginning of his career?
I would say yes, but I wouldn't put this, the racism, on the same level as, let's say, white supremacist racism. And I think that racism that Elijah Muhammad had preached is very, very sort of natural, if one can call it this way. You know, if, for example, you know, every time you walk down the street, police beat you up or pull you over for no particular reason, whether that police person is black or white, it doesn't matter. After a while, you'll grow up with a kind of a distaste and dislike or even hate for police, you see. I think the reaction, the racist reaction of Elijah Muhammad was something like that, you know, and basically what it did, despite its negativity, it did achieve a very, very important cultural shift from the black internalization of white supremacism to a black affirmation of their superiority over white people. But in fact, it wasn't really supposed to be like that. You know, in fact, what it did was it overturned a racism against white supremacism by creating a supremacism of its own. It was a falsehood, but it did wake a lot of people up. And then in the process, you find that people started to find contradictions just in their lives, you know, just in terms of relating with other Muslims and so forth. They found contradictions in this and they went towards the truth.
Thank you, Sheikh. And Ahmed, I'm going to come back to you before the show ends. We've only got a few minutes left, unfortunately. But just tell me, I mean, obviously there's a lot of questions surrounding his death. We don't quite know what's happened because there's a lot of conspiracies there. But tell me, what have we lost and what do you make of how he ended? I mean, it's surely not coincidence that one of these great leaders of the community was ended in such an appalling and suspicious way.
Of course it is. What was taken from us was someone who is and was a role model. And I think that we should end on that point, because we see him as a role model, and then when you go through his autobiography, you can understand how we can be role models for future Malcolm X's. What I mean by that is, when you read his autobiography, you notice that he looks up to the strength of his mother and his father. So how does his autobiography open? It opens with a retelling of how his mum stood down a crowd of KKK members who'd come with torches in the middle of the night. She stood them down, and that must have been a formative memory for him. And again, he had a high opinion. He had his criticisms, but he had a high opinion of his father's attempts at also reviving pride in the black community. So what we need to see in ourselves is, yes, Malcolm X is a role model for us today, but how can we be the role model for the future Malcolm X's? We need to have the strength in ourselves as individuals, as parents, as community members, if we want to see another Malcolm X rise up. Because, you know, it's really tempting to sort of like mythologize him, to sort of compartmentalize him, to say that he was a man of that time, wasn't he great, and then just leave it at that, leave his autobiography and his lessons as a dusty book on the shelf. What we need to realize is that he was a role model. He had his role models. If you want to see his like again today, we need to be the role models and have that strength as well.
That's a fantastic point to end on. How can we keep Malcolm X's legacy going today? Thank you very much, Ahmed, and to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif as well for joining us in the studio today. But that's all the time we have for this edition of the show, unfortunately. And thank you to everyone at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, Assalamu Alaikum.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear listeners, dear youth, my friends, welcome back to another episode of Youth Station. Well, this is IRIB English Radio. I am Asma, and here with me I have brother Mahdi.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Pleasure to be here.
Of course, always. It's home and it's sweet home.
Well, by snowing outside and I'm indoors, that's something that's bugging me constantly. Good, everything's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing's too bad.
The same old dramas in life. Plus, today is snowy.
Yep, something's very positive about today.
Of course, yeah.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask his blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So, do you know the story of Narcissus? Well, in mythology, as you go through different stories, there was this story of Eco and Narcissus, which was very beautiful. Now, when we bring Eco into the story, it would turn into a romantic story. But then when we talk about Narcissus himself, it's going to be a psychological story to talk about.
Okay, let's go into the psychology.
Narcissus was a beautiful person. I'm just going to give you the gist. He was a very, very handsome, I suppose to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then he, to the point that he rejected all the lovers. You know what I mean? So, and then what happened is that one day, he's been cursed. And then one day, by the gods and goddesses, and then one day, as he was walking in the woods, getting into the river, he saw the reflection of his face on the river, on the surface of the river. Mm. And then what do you think happened?
Fell in love with himself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then he fell in love with himself. And then, since he's been cursed, he melted in the passion of himself and the passion he held for himself. And then he killed himself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, are you a narcissistic person or not?
Wow, I don't know. Like, I feel a bit I feel nausea right now. Like, I'm going to throw up. Am I or am I not?
I guess every single one of us is in our own way.
In our own way, we care about ourselves, yeah. We pay attention to ourselves, yeah.
We love ourselves.
Yeah, naturally. However, are we at that level where we'd, you know, disregard other people completely just to, you know, serve our own wills or desires or something like that. Yeah, there is where people differ.
Yeah, right?
There are different people. Mm-hmm. However, yeah, I might have definition, right, of something that's wrong, right? And
of being an egoistic person.
Of being an egoistic, yeah. Yeah, that too. Oppression. Okay, oppression. Let's keep it oppression. I might define oppression in a manner and criticize, oppose oppression, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there might be a certain amount of oppressiveness that I have within my character, within myself, that I do display at times. I, myself, and I'm inattentive to that percentage or that level of oppressiveness that I have within myself.
Yeah.
But then I oppose oppression, right?
Yes.
That's beyond that percentage or a bit more than that level of oppression that I have within myself.
Yeah, now the story is getting too complicated. Let's go for a break and then please do clarify situation.
All right, let's go.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, speaking of oppression.
Yeah. For example, let's explain through the example that I have in my mind.
Yeah, that's the best way. Thank you for doing that. Yeah.
Example is, I'm reading the Quran.
Yes.
And I read the stories of Pharaoh, and he was like, he called himself God. He said, I'm the one who kills, and I'm the one who
gives life.
And oh, I've got this power, and I can exercise it the way I want, all that. And I, in my mind, I'm like, oh, what a horrible person, you know?
Yes.
Then I have to realize that what if I had that power and that absolute, you know, no one's questioning what I'm doing in the world, like in the world as he knew it.
Top of the hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's the alpha predator. You know, like there's no one after him. at that stage, if I'm at that stage, am I going to be any better, right? Whereas I've got a child. I've got, you know, a child.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I treat my child, because I have that power. Now, child, a young one, right?
Yes.
Well, if they're grown up or like 20, 25, that's different, right?
Yes.
Because now they've got this certain level of capability to defend themselves, right? Now,
yeah.
Now, that's different. For example, your child is, you know, a toddler, whatever.
Yes.
So the way I treat my children, or like for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given a man a certain... He has given him the right to make certain choices when it comes to the house, right?
Yes.
In the household.
Yeah.
Now, because I have that right.
Yeah.
Fair enough, I do have that right. Because I have that right, does that right make me oppressive? Right?
A dictator.
A dictator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like is that what I'm doing? If I'm doing that, right, and I'm abusing the power that I've been given, then I am no different to that Pharaoh.
Yeah,
the Pharaoh that I am so criticizing.
The
right?
mighty king.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I meant by the levels that I have in my mind, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I might have a certain percentage of, you know, the oppression that I exercise within my home, right?
Yeah.
But then when I see it, like, in the society, I'm like, oh, this guy's going to go hell.
And I would say that every single one of us have got a sample of that king in ourselves.
Ooh, it's not bad, though. It's not that bad.
Yes, as long as you're not taking it to the excessive borders.
Yeah, why is it not bad? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala... in the Quran quotes a prophet, and he says that the prophet said, Allah has made you muluk, right? Every single person
is a king.
Is a king.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that mean? It means that, well, the person you're talking to is also a king.
Exactly.
You never treat that person as if he's your slave. You can't do that. That's also a king. So there's going to be unrest. There's going to be war.
Of course. But when we are in relationships, we don't look at the issue like that.
Yeah, we don't. Exactly. But when it comes to looking at myself and treating my self-respect and my honor as if I'm the king and I am a king, right?
Yeah.
Whereas treating the person that's before me as if he's, well, not a king, whatever you look at it. However you look at it. But if I'm doing that, then of course there's going to be unrest in society. Of course there's going to be a problem between the two individuals. Because, you know, someone has got a complex. He's
of
got
course.
A superiority complex.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is a complex, of course.
Of course it's a complex.
Yeah.
It's just...
And the reason is the amount of respect you give to your own ego. And you don't care about other people's ego or character. Just like the way you said it. If I think I'm a king, I should think that the person who's in front of me is also
a king. Yeah. So the relations.
So we should treat each other accordingly.
Yeah, diplomatically, you know.
Yeah.
You need to have diplomatic relations, an embassy in their heart, and they have an embassy in your heart. Is there a time for break or do we?
Yes, it's time for break.
Let's hit it.
But I'm just living it for you.
Okay. Well, okay, there's a break. Let's go.
Welcome back. This is still Youth Station. We're talking about the egos and how much Hitler I have in myself.
Before we had the break, I remember this this ideology that certain people within the Shia have.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opinion or it's a school of thought. You know, like even within Shias, there are different philosophical and, you know, different schools of thought.
Yeah.
One of them, they talk about further than just the metaphysics, right? That's where they talk about Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he was talking to the soldiers of Yazid.
Yeah.
On the day of
Ashura.
And in Karbala. So he talks about them. He's like he explains to them. He's trying to make them understand the crucial point that these people are standing in their lives. So yeah. This is a crucial point, right? That he's trying to explain to them and trying to make them understand, but they were standing
at an abyss.
Yeah. And he was trying to show them that it's where they are right now. But it was as if it were, you know, they couldn't hear or they couldn't see or whatever. Like, they were just, you know, as if they were
ignorant to what they heard.
Yeah, like statues. They were just there, right?
Yeah.
And then he explains, he says, well, because your stomachs is filled with haram, right?
Forbidden food.
Mm. The word the Imam uses, the word is butun, right? And the thing is, in Arabic, the jam'a, like the plural for batn, which is a stomach, is butun, and the plural for batin is also butun, right?
Yeah.
Imam is...
That is the soul?
Yeah, which refers to the soul. Batin is the esoteric perspective, right? Yeah. So some people, like the ulama, the people of knowledge, they're saying that Imam al-Islam is trying to explain to them that before you were here, before you physically arrived, and to do what? To martyr, to kill an imam. That takes a lot of wrong courage, right? Yeah. You have to be very bold to be able to stand in front of him with the intention of killing him. So Imam alayhi salatu wasalam says that your souls had done this before your bodies arrived here to do it, right?
Yeah.
Because your soul is going to tell you a lot of times that, look, this is wrong.
Yeah.
Don't do this.
And we have it in the Holy Book of Quran. God has given us. God has given us the good and the right and the bad.
Precisely.
And we know it instinctively.
Exactly. Right? So there's an imam within you.
Yeah.
Right? So so within you there was an imam. And within you there was an oppressor.
First you killed that.
That imam within yourself. Yeah. The oppressor that you had within your soul. He had the power. He overpowered your positiveness, and that oppressor within your soul had killed the imam.
Exactly.
For you to have the courage.
That was the overwinning imam in you.
Yeah.
That killed the light.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the oppressor in your soul.
Yeah.
He killed the imam, which is why you're here now, physically, to kill an imam.
So that's the whole story with the life itself. You can apply that everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah, precisely.
Yeah. So we have been given the good and the bad, and what is the way to achieve the truth, and how to find it, and how to act according to it. But then if we give too much of value to that ego that exists inside of us, and then you gave it different names right now, if we give it too much of respect, if we listen to whatever single thing that it's going to tell us, then life is going to turn into a horrible disaster.
Oh, yeah. Your afterlife is going to be in trouble as well.
Of course, yeah. The future, which is going to be eternal, is going to be a miserable eternity. And that's very sad. So we should be very much careful about our ego and about the things that we have inside of us that might kill us one day. So that's all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Malcolm X was the iconic leader of African American Muslims and a civil rights activist who was assassinated 58 years ago. The iconic leader was born in 1925 and was jailed for robbery in 1946. In prison, he was introduced to the Nation of Islam and became influenced by the teachings of its leader. He was assassinated at the age of 39 on the 21st of February 1965 by three men. Now, after 58 years, his daughter says federal agencies concealed evidence of his murder and she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York City Police and others for his death. Eliza Shabazz accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claimed the evidence shows the agency conspired to assassinate Malcolm X. Shabazz says she seeks $100 million in damages.
For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder, and we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father. Thank you.
The slaying of the black leader has been the subject of speculation about the potential involvement of secret government agencies in his assassination. Back then, the FBI infiltrated black rights movements in a bid to dismantle them. Malcolm X was a lead spokesman for the Nation of Islam. The group advocated separatism for black Americans. Malcolm X later split from the organization and toned down some of his radical views. In the 1950s, the United States reckoned with its prevalent racism, and Malcolm X's assassination was a turning point back then. The civil rights movement, which was a campaign to abolish racial segregation, discrimination, and disenfranchisement throughout the United States, culminated in the 1960s. Various individuals and groups, most notably Martin Luther King, struggled to rid the United States of its institutional racism. But despite years of struggle and some success, structural racism is still rampant in the U.S.
It has failed, and it's very tragic. There's been so much suffering, you know, even when there is progress in the 1960s during what's often referred to as the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, there were gains made, but at the same time that there were legislative remedies made, immediately we see the mass incarceration system beginning. And we see neoliberalism taking hold, which impoverished so many millions of people.
The median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people. And black people are also less likely to benefit from home ownership, the engine of generational wealth in America. Black couples are also more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to be denied a mortgage or a home improvement loan. Furthermore, only about 5.7% of physicians in the U.S. identify as black or African American. This statistic does not reflect the communities they serve, as an estimated 12% of the U.S. population is black or African American. One reason for this disproportionate number is that black people have been historically excluded from medicine, and life expectancy has declined slightly for African Americans. A black child born today is likely to live up to 74.7 years, 4 years less than a white baby.
So with if there is not a commitment at the top, if there's not seriousness about acknowledging racism and its impact, then we end up with the situation where we're in now, where the U.S. continually claims to be this racism-free country, when in fact it is anything but.
¶¶
In a State of the Nation address in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin has defended Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Putin accused the U.S.-led NATO alliance of fanning the flames of the conflict in the mistaken belief that it could defeat Moscow in a global confrontation. He blamed the West for starting the conflict in Ukraine, saying Western countries led by the United States were seeking unlimited power in world affairs. The Russian president said Moscow was not fighting the people of Ukraine, stressing that Ukraine has become a hostage of the Kyiv regime and its Western masters, which have effectively occupied the country. He also accused the U.S.-led NATO of using the conflict as a pretext to supply Kyiv with arms and munitions. Putin warned that the more long-range weapons are sent to Ukraine, the longer Russia will push threats away from its borders. In an important announcement, Putin said Russia was suspending participation in a major arms control agreement with the U.S.
I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in the New START treaty. Let me repeat, Russia does not abandon the treaty but suspends its participation in it.
The New START treaty was signed in Prague in 2010. It came into force the following year and was extended in 2021 for 5 more years after United States President Joe Biden took office. It caps the number of strategic nuclear warheads that the U.S. and Russia can deploy and deployment of land and submarine-based missiles and bombers to deliver them. Together, Russia and the U.S. hold about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin also hailed the resistance of the Russian economy in the face of massive sanctions by the West.
As I already mentioned, the West is launching not just a military and informational war against us, but has also opened an economic front. But it is achieving nothing nowhere and will not achieve anything.
He added that the Russian economy has managed to do well despite Western countries' predictions of its collapse. Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual speech coincided U.S. President Joe Biden's unannounced trip to Ukraine and Poland. Biden stepped up his anti-Russia rhetoric during his trip. He pledged more arms for Kyiv and a fresh round of sanctions against Russia during a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. Biden proclaimed unwavering support for Kyiv and a commitment to bolstering NATO's eastern flank facing Russia. Biden's trip has also drawn criticism from inside America. Conservative Republicans have censured his decision to travel to an active war zone without a significant American military presence. They argue that instead Biden should have visited the border with Mexico or the Ohio town stricken by toxic waste spilled from a derailed train. Kevin Hearn, a House Republican from Oklahoma, who chairs the influential Republican Study Committee, said the president's now spent more time in Kyiv than he has at our southern border. House Republican David Kostoff said there are a lot of people here in the U.S. that would say he probably should have gone to Ohio and visited with the people who have been afflicted by the derailment first. Also, the right-wing American lawmaker Marjorie Taylor Greene said Biden chose Ukraine over America, while forcing the American people to pay for Ukraine's government and war. I cannot express how much Americans hate Joe Biden. The comments from Republicans were in many ways business as usual for the Biden presidency. The GOP has hammered him since practically the start of his administration for the increase in migrant arrivals on the southern border and more recently seized on the East Palestine derailment to argue his administration is turning a blind eye to an environmental disaster. East Palestine's mayor, Trent Conaway, said that Biden's Ukraine trip was the biggest slap in the face. That tells you right now he doesn't care about people. Last month, Biden visited Texas's border with Mexico shortly after he announced new restrictions on migrants who arrive in the United States, which drew opposition from advocacy groups and progressive Democrats. But the comments from the Republican lawmakers could also be harbingers of major political battles to come. Since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has supplied Kyiv with about $30 billion worth of weaponry and other aid, but the country has asked for more. That will require the agreement of both the Biden administration and his Democratic allies controlling the Senate, as well as the Republicans in control of the House of Representatives. A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Despite calls for dialogue and a peaceful solution to end the conflict, Western nations, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine, including heavy military equipment. This trend has only escalated the conflict, and prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Also, it seems that Ukraine's allies are gearing up for a much longer war. In his first trip to Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict, U.S. President Joe Biden met with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. During his hours-long surprise visit to Kyiv, Biden said he was there to show his country's unwavering support for Ukraine.
And I'm here to show our unwavering support for the nation's independence, their sovereignty, and territorial integrity. And today, I hope we're going to have a chance to discuss how the United States and our allies, by keeping constant contact with them, and our partners, can most effectively support you and your cause, Mr. President.
And later, at a joint presser with Zelensky, Biden promised increased arms deliveries to Ukraine.
We've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems. All defend Ukraine, and that doesn't count the other $500 million we're announcing with you today and tomorrow.
Zelensky hailed the visit as a key sign of support, saying Russia does not stand a chance of winning the war.
This is an unequivocal signal that Russian attempts to win will have no chance. Together, we will protect our cities and our people from the terror of Russia.
While Biden was in Kyiv, the U.S. State Department announced a further $460 million in aid to Ukraine. The assistance includes $450 million in artillery ammunition, anti-armor systems, and air radars, as well as $10 million for energy infrastructure. Biden's visit to Ukraine was the first trip to the country by a U.S. president in 15 years. The visit came 4 days before the first anniversary of the breakout of the war between Ukraine and Russia. Moscow has repeatedly warned the West against providing Kyiv with weapons, saying it would only prolong the conflict. Now, Biden's trip has clearly sent a contradictory message to Moscow. That is, the influx of weapons to Ukraine will continue and that Washington exactly wants the war to go on. Since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Western countries, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending arms to the country rather than supporting dialogue. Now, the U.S. has accused China of planning to send weapons to Russia in its war with Ukraine, warning Beijing that any supplies would cause a serious problem.
We have seen Chinese companies, and of course in China there's really no distinction between private companies and the state. We have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support. And we've made very clear to them that that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
Blinken said he had made it clear to his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, during the Munich Security Conference that Beijing would face consequences if it moved ahead with assisting Russia in the war. The warning comes as the U.S. has been the largest provider of weapons to Ukraine during the year-long war with Russia. In reaction to Blinken's comments, China rejected the accusation, saying it's the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield.
It is the U.S., not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the U.S. pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even cursing us.
China has expressed deep concern over the Ukraine conflict getting out of control. Beijing has also urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire while pledging to promote dialogue to resolve the conflict.
is no end in sight to the Israeli atrocities in the region. In the latest development, the regime carried out yet another airstrike near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Several people were killed and over a dozen injured. The attack heavily damaged nearby residential buildings. That after missiles hit the densely populated Kfar Susa neighborhood in central Damascus.